Nowadays, many of us read in the faint glow of some kind of electronic screen, and we flit from one source to another, seeking those tidbits of knowledge that will inform, instruct, and keep us up to date on the newest scandal in Washington or the latest cat video to go viral. Can Kafka or Dostoevsky effectively compete with what's left of our attention? Well, in his new book, Slow Reading in a Hurried Age, David Mikic makes the case for a different kind of relationship with text, contemplative, intense, and unrushed. His book is published by the Harvard Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Now, reading slower won't make our emails any more worthy of contemplation, will they?
No, and in fact, yeah, I've yet to see an anthology of memorable emails or tweets. No doubt that's coming, but I think that it'll be some time. I think that a lot of the writing that people do nowadays, even on Twitter, Twitter is occasionally aphoristic, but it's very sort of ragged and casual most of the time, and our emails even more so, and our instant messages. A lot of this is just talk in written form, and what I really want to lead people back to is the idea of the memorability of writing, of being able to be absorbed by a piece of literature.
Well, I'd imagine that Hemingway would have been very good at tweeting. But maybe Faulkner or Proust would have had a really hard time.
It's hard to imagine Faulkner or Proust confining themselves to 140 characters, yes.
Is part of the problem simply that we live in a digital age?
I think that is a big part of the problem. And I'm old enough to remember even a time without answering machines. And so the idea... It's happened more and more in the last 10 years. This is really a recent phenomenon. The idea that we are supposed to be reachable at any moment. We can be asked to respond to a message at any time, day or night. And we really need to create a sort of refuge for ourselves, an escape, a little desert island, if you will.
Well, judging from what I see on the subway, there are a fair number of people who are listening to their iPods, but there are still a lot of people who are reading on the subway, whether they're reading old-fashioned books, I saw somebody reading a Flannery O'Connor, or they may be reading on a Kindle or a Nook, but they're still reading.
I agree, yeah, the people will always be reading, they'll always come back to it. I was on the subway the other day, and there was a kid of about 13 or 14 years old, and he said, Catcher in the Rye, I've read that like 12 times. And so people still keep going back to their favorite books. This is something that
I worry for that kid. Yeah.
It has had a bad effect on some.
Do most people read now in a utilitarian way for information rather than for insights or just a simple pleasure of spending time with an interesting writer's mind?
I think this is the main effect of the digital age, that increasingly we're primed to read for information, for just grabbing what we need as quickly as possible. Speed is of the essence, we think. But we lose out on an incredible amount as a result. It's a whole world that we're losing out on, and a whole sense of, and the sense of ourselves we get by being immersed in a book, too.
In this book, when you discuss reading, are you always talking about literature?
Well, it depends on how you define literature. I would define good, serious nonfiction as literature, too. It uses literary strategies, and I talk about some books of that nature in my slow reading book. What I do really is just offer a tour of some of my – I loved writing this book, by the way, because I got to talk about so many of my favorite books, sort of poured all of my passionate admiration and attachment to these books into this. And really my point is to try to lead people through them and to show them how they might get more or get even more out of Austen or Dostoevsky or Shakespeare or whatever they're interested in.
But aren't you preaching to the choir to some degree, somebody who's going to be – interested in reading a book like this is somebody who's already interested in reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, preaching to the choir is what I do, and I'm not embarrassed about that. But what I think that anyone, of course, anyone picking up the book will be interested in reading, and it's addressed to a general audience, to people who have loved reading, who want to read more, who feel that they just don't have time, or who would like to pick up some skills, some ways to do it better for more pleasure and profit.
But I've even discovered that when I recommend a book to a writer, mm-hmm. writers who generally are well-read, they're not necessarily going to trust me. So if I say you must read The Makioka Sisters, or you must read Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. I have a few other books that, The Good Soldier, that I think should be read more. They say, okay, and of course then they never read them. So in the end, you really got to come to that book by yourself, don't you?
It's a very personal matter, an individual reader's attachment to a book, and it often happens by accident. And this is another effect of the internet, by the way. There's so much on the internet. It's just so omnipresent and so universal that it's very hard to find something that might speak to you individually there. It's a bit of a paradox, but I remember when I was a kid going to a little library on the Jersey Shore, and I found the most amazing things there. It was precisely because it was such a small place, such a limited place, that the power to just, you know, come upon something that would really take you over, that would really sort of make you head over heels in love with that book.
Well, you write about a short story by Jorge Luis Borges called The Library of Babel, is it?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds a little like what Google's trying to assemble right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but wouldn't that be a good thing? Because having access to every book in and out of print might encourage reading.
Well, I don't want to knock Google completely. I think they've done an enormous service for scholars, and I rely on Google Books all the time. I do think that what we need to try to recover is a smaller, a more local, a more personal way of encountering knowledge and of encountering books. And that's what I mean to do in slow reading, just by sharing some of my own experiences of some of my favorites and introducing people to them.
Well, you say that how you read matters much more than what you read.
I think that's true, in the sense that I'm not trying to force on people certain classics. I'm not trying to say, oh, you must read Shakespeare, you must read Tolstoy. My point is rather that whatever you'd like to read, you can really benefit from approaching it with care and with, my key word is slowness, with a kind of patience and slowness, and with a readiness, a receptivity to what the author is trying to tell you. Authors are trying to introduce you to a whole world, the world of the book, and you need to try to get to know the landscape. And you also need to try to cultivate a relationship with the author. It really is like a deep friendship that occurs when you immerse yourself in a book.
What happens in that library in the Borges story?
Well, it drives you crazy because people are convinced that they're going to somehow find the one book that is their book, and they spend their whole lives searching for that book, and they never come upon it.
Didn't pundits predict that movies, radio, television, comic books all signaled the end of civilization? They predicted that it would kill off reading, but it hasn't.
In the 18th century, it was newspapers that were supposed to kill off reading. But yes, it hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen. People will still read, and they'll still read with the same wonderful absorption and the same passion. But today, these days, there's more obstacles than ever before. I really think this is true. I've seen this in my students as well as in my friends and in myself, too. I also get distracted.
So it's just the distractions, the fact that there are so many things available on the internet.
That's it. And I think that also we're increasingly being surrounded by a kind of writing that does not ask for our full attention.
Haven't we also had a goal to read faster, which would allow us to read even more?
Yes. And this has been a problem. The idea that we should be gulping down the latest thing, the new book or the new sensational bit of news, something that will grab us and so that we'll be up to the minute or in the know. But really, we need an antidote to that. We need a refuge so that we're not constantly being nagged in this fashion by media. In the 19th century, John Ruskin, who was one of the great apostles of reading, referred to, and I love this phrase, shallow, blotching, blundering, infectious information. And he put information in quotation marks.
So this goes back a while. Well, we have Evelyn Wood and speed reading. And I remember Woody Allen used to tell a joke about taking a speed reading course and then getting through War and Peace in 20 minutes. And then he asked, it's about Russia, isn't it?
Indeed. And that's what happened. So, but the more time you spend, the more you get out of it, and the more pleasure you have, and the more that you're encouraged to go back to those favorite books. I think everyone should have a short shelf of favorite books, something that they, that their sort of personal canon that they'll go back to again and again.
My guest is David Mikics, M-I-K-I-C-S. His book, Slow Reading in a Hurried Age, is published by Harvard University Press and the Belknap imprint. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with David Mikics, who's written a book called Slow Reading in a Hurried Age. It is published by Harvard University Press and the Belknap imprint. What led you to even think about writing this? Is it because of the way your students are striking you these days?
That played a role, and I love my students. I have the greatest time with them. Somebody once defined teaching as talking about books with young people, and of course, it's really people of all ages. I have students of all ages, but that's one of the things I love about it, and just the joint project of working on a book together, of really getting into it.
But do you find that kids are not as well read as they might have been 20 or 30 years ago? I know people are constantly complaining that they have fewer writing skills than they did in the past.
I hesitate to make a blanket assessment like that. I mean, I have my impression like everyone does, and I think my impression varies somewhat from year to year, depending on the latest crop of students. So I really don't want to put it in general terms. But what I would say is that, especially for young people, this electronic environment is becoming a real problem, that teenage bedrooms at night are really a sort of command center. You know, you have to, they have to respond to message upon message from their friends.
You quote a scientist who claims that the internet has reshaped our brains and that it's potentially addictive. Really?
Well, I've been reading more and more about people who at least they feel that they're addicted to the games that they carry on their iPhones, for example. And I do think that this happens. It doesn't mean it's not addiction, certainly in some physical or unbreakable sense. You know, you can get out of it, and I describe the way to get out of it.
What's the Freedom app?
The Freedom app is something that I started using a couple years ago, and what it enables you to do is block internet access on your computer for a certain amount of time, say 4 hours or 8 hours. And I and a number of writers that I know use it to work so that they can have that sort of quiet space.
So Freedom app is just another word for nothing left to choose?
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. There was a piece by Evgeny Morozov who said that he actually locks his DSL cable in a timed safe so that he wouldn't have internet access for a week or so. But that's I think that's going a bit too far.
You point out that 60 years ago, Reuben Brower of Harvard instituted a course in which he called slow reading. What kinds of exercises did the course consist of?
Well, this is a fascinating example of how this idea got started, of slow reading, or sometimes called deep reading or close reading. What Brower told his students at Harvard some 50 years ago was that they were to think of the book that they were both working on, both discussing, the teacher and the students, as a sort of dramatic event. That is, try to inhabit it, try to get into the roles, try to hear the dialogue, try to understand the relation of one character to another by getting into that world as much as possible. And I think that's still the right advice.
Well, a good writer does that to you automatically. But is it possible to do deep reading on the subway or when you're reading a Kindle?
Oh, I've done it not only on the subway, but also in the park while my 3-year-old son was in the sandbox. He's at the age where he likes to be undisturbed in the sandbox. And so last summer I read War and Peace while he was playing. And of course, every few minutes I would have to get up and tie his shoe or something like that. But
well, when you're on the subway, you can miss your stop if you really get into
it. I have
book.
Done that. I've taken the M all the way to Williamsburg rather than the F to Carroll Gardens.
You also write about the purpose of the Midrash. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
Yes. I talk about the way in which, in a sense, close reading or slow reading started off in ancient Israel when the rabbis were so attuned to the exact nuances of words in the Hebrew Bible. For example, there are certain days, the 6 days of creation, there are certain days that are said not to be good. The one day that's said not to be good is the day on which the heavens are separated from what's below. And so they found the reason for that. That's not good. And
they were creating stories on top of the stories that they were being provided.
Yeah, they provided what's called in Hollywood backstories for the characters in the Bible, and some of them quite outlandish and fantastic. And it's a wonderfully imaginative thing to do, to explore these midrashic fables and fantasies about characters. But it's also something that's in some way departs from the text that we're talking about.
Well, today we see it in fanlit, don't we? And even in some literary fiction, books like Longbourn, which imagines Pride and Prejudice from the point of view of the servants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I haven't read that one yet, but I'm a great admirer of Austen and of Pride and Prejudice, so I look forward to doing that. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's fantastic.
Now, you also advocate memorization. It seems to me that if I'm reading a book and I get caught up in it, the world of that book, the last thing I want to do is start memorizing. I just want to keep going with the flow.
Well, I hear you. And again, when I have a number of recommendations in this book, different sort of rules for reading, suggestions for reading. Be patient, take notes, at least a few, reread, notice the beginnings and endings of books. And memorization is one of these suggestions that I have. But some people will be drawn to that more than others.
Well, what did Kafka say about patience?
Kafka said that patience, he said that impatience was the thing that got us kicked out of the Garden of Eden.
Mm. So we should be patient.
And, well, he didn't suggest that we might get back in, being Kafka, of course.
Many people get hooked on the plot, want to find out what's happened, don't care about all those other things.
Well, that's also a legitimate impulse. It drives you forward, particularly, you know, in a thriller, in a suspenseful book. And I have nothing against that. I get driven forward, too, in that same way. But then you can go back after you've finished. One of the most wonderful things to do, one of the greatest exercises that will really enrich your reading, is to look back on the book that you've just finished.
One of your rules is to ask the right questions. How do you even know what the right questions are?
Well, I start off in that rule with a couple of, I think, easy examples. What about the titles of books? For example, Pride and Prejudice. Does the book suggest, once you finish Pride and Prejudice, you can go back and think about that title? Can Pride exist without prejudice? I mean, people often say that Darcy represents pride and that Elizabeth Bennet represents prejudice. But is it really so simple? Maybe the two characteristics are more entwined than that.
War and Peace is a lot easier.
I think, that's pretty directly descriptive, yes.
Or the Brothers Karamazov.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that the remaining 10 rules are a bit of a diagram for getting this one right?
For getting that first
one. Asking the right questions.
Asking the right questions. In a sense, yes. And again, I'm not going to play umpire or judge that, oh, you've asked a bad question and therefore you should stop reading and start over again. I simply am trying to guide people in a direction that I think will increase their enjoyment and make reading a whole lot more fun. And I think it does get a lot more fun the more time you spend and the more you think about in particular, I wind up in the last rule with talking about the relation of books to one another, let's go back to Austen, the relation of a book like Pride and Prejudice or Persuasion to Emma. You can learn an awful lot about a person by asking, what's your favorite Jane Austen novel? Persuasion is a subtle, rather somber, delicate book, and Emma is absolutely wild, just outrageous.
Well, a lot of people insist on identifying with the narrator of a novel, although one of the questions is, why did the writer write this in first person or second person or third person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, that is often a question. Even when a novel is in third person, though, we do identify. And again, Emma is a wonderful example. She's in many ways an extremely irritating character, at least to some readers. She's a snob. She's extraordinarily self-centered. And yet when we read, we do identify with her. And I think, you know, we find her almost irresistible. So why is that?
Well, there are different kinds of third person. There's the omnipotent third-person narrator, and then mm-hmm. there's the third-person narrator that really is a first-person narrator, only telling the story in third-person.
Yes, this was a technique that Flaubert in particular, I don't know if I can say he pioneered it, but he certainly made a major advance in that sort of narration called free indirect style, in which even though things are in third person, you're really hearing the thoughts of a character, in this case, Madame Bovary. And, you know, her ideas, her point of view really come through very clearly in that story, which is told in that novel, which is told in third person.
What would have happened if he had told it in first person?
He
would have had to deal with some of her flaws a little more subtly, wouldn't he?
Well, I think what would have happened is that we would have become overwhelmed by her consciousness, which in so many ways is so obsessive and so self-lacerating, so that what he's really doing in giving us the third person is giving us a certain distance from Madame Bovary. He also lets us know what he thinks about her, not just what she thinks about herself.
And she wouldn't have written with such wonderful style.
She certainly wouldn't have, yes.
She was not as smart as Flaubert.
Yeah, but again, that's part of the magic of the novel, that we identify with her so much, even though her imagination is so restricted. She really would not be a good writer. She does not have a great imagination.
Are some writing styles difficult for a modern reader to appreciate because there's so much of their time, or the vocabulary is out of the ordinary?
I think this is true, and I give a couple of examples of this. And again, one needs to slow down, sometimes even to use the dictionary to look up unfamiliar words and to try to appreciate a rhythm that's different from the one we're used to. Edmund Burke is one example of a writer who seems so poised, so self-assured, and sometimes circumlocutory in his style that we feel sometimes that we're not ready for it.
Well, it's a lot easier to read Hemingway than Proust or Henry James or William Faulkner.
Yes, in our own day, too, James and Proust are, well, close to our own day, James and Proust are great examples of writers who really can be frustrating, unless you make the time for them, unless you slow down and really appreciate the rhythm of their sentences.
And they're doing that on purpose, aren't they, in their writing?
Yes, they want to.
They knew how to write simple sentences.
They did. And
and Faulkner knew how to write a sentence that was less than a full page.
Yes, you could, if you search carefully, find a simple sentence in Henry James or even in Faulkner. But yes, that wasn't what they wanted to do. And yeah, it was to make us think. It was precisely to make us think. And we need skill. We need to cultivate a certain sort of discernment in order to read a novel by a late novel by James, for example. But it's worth it. It's eminently worth it.
You say that writers use signposts to direct the reader. What are signposts?
Well, a signpost would be a governing image or an image that really tips you off that something important is happening in the book, something that perhaps you'll look back to. One very familiar example is near the beginning of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, where there's a train accident at the moment when Anna first meets the man who's going to become her lover, Vronsky.
And then, of course, there's a train at the end.
There's a train accident at the end.
But that's a foreshadowing, isn't it?
It is, yes. But we're meant to remember that earlier scene. And so that would be one case of a signpost. Another is in the book, I look very carefully at a Chekhov short story called Gooseberries. There are several signposts in that story: the rain, the smoke from a pipe, and of course the gooseberries themselves. And that's a case in which I think it really pays to think and look carefully at a short piece of fiction, because Chekhov's Gooseberries, like many of his stories, seem so casual and mysterious and so intuitive, and yet it's very precisely structured. And once we look back at it in that light, we really learn a lot.
What do you mean when you advise readers to write it down?
Well, what I mean is that, well, I have a bad memory, so I'm always writing things down when I'm reading. But even if you have a good memory, I think it really enhances your appreciation. It really takes you a step further to jot down a few notes about what you're reading, or to make some notes in the margins, even if it's just an exclamation point.
And sometimes we are fascinated by the marginalia of great writers when they read other writers. But sometimes you can know too much. Nabokov knew enough about Beatles to know that Kafka got it all wrong when he when he made George Samson turn into a Beatle.
Yes, yes. This is a famous incident. Nabokov, who loved Kafka and lectured on him at Cornell when Nabokov was at Cornell, he mentioned Nabokov, of course, was a lepidopterist. He loved he knew a lot about insects of other kinds, not just butterflies. And so he said that Kafka made a mistake, that in the Metamorphosis, Samsa would have had wings and he could have just have flown away.
Nabokov loved writing notes. That's why he wrote Pnin, I think. But what is we have very little time. Still, what does Virginia Woolf say in her essay, How Should One Read a Book?
Well, Virginia Woolf says it was one of the wonderful prophets of reading, one of the wonderful critics and guides to reading through the whole course of literature. She says that one shouldn't dictate to the author, one should try to become him. And that's a tall order, really. But what I think one should really do, perhaps a little less intimidating, is to try to have a relationship with the author, to have a conversation with the author.
Well, you're creating the book along with the author because you're imagining things in your head that the next reader is not necessarily imagining.
Every book is a deeply personal experience, yes.
David Mikic's book, Slow Reading in a Hurried Age, is published by Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.